The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it, we can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. We talk today about cleansing karma through mindfulness or trusting the meditation so we can change our old karmically conditioned reactions into responses instead. That's what real responsibility is about. It's the ability to respond from that place of stillness rather than simply react out of old conditioned habits. I'm going to read a bit from Reverend Master Jiyu's discussion on the five laws of the universe about karma, because I think it's wonderfully relevant. And two extremely relevant parts are the little footnotes. In this little book on the introduction to the Sri Reflection Meditation tradition has really good footnotes, even better than the original footnotes. Everybody knows, I assume by this time, that the karma is simply the universal law of cause and effect. Just as in physics, every action has an equal and opposite reaction. So this law works in the same way. There isn't a lawgiver or a judge, and there's nobody up there deciding he had a good breakfast, so you're going to get off light today. or an argument with his wife, so you're going to get off not so light today. One way of seeing karma is habit energy. It's volitional actions. And when those volitional actions are based on stillness, then you're likely to have not such bad results. When they're based on greed and anger and fear, you get other results. This is what she said about the law of karma, though. This is, you should keep this in mind. The reader should be aware of it, that this statement, like all statements about the operation of the law of karma, is an oversimplification and an approximation. The full scope and operation of this law is so vast and complex that it can be understood only by the mind of a Buddha. Karma is not a substance which has a physical location. And the use of the words sparks or karmic residues does not imply a material existence for them, although they may be recognized in meditation. It's helpful to see that mindfulness is a choice. You're choosing to be aware, or you're choosing to be wandering off somewhere else. And volitional actions is what causes results. You're choosing all the time to put your mind in a certain place. And you can also choose to just let the mind be like the dog chasing the stick, just wandering forever and ever. Most of the time when the dog's chasing the stick, we're not aware that the dog is chasing the stick. We're just thinking that the stick is really wonderful here. And this wonderful Tibetan monk had the image of the fact that he said, a lion doesn't look at the stick. A lion looks at who threw the stick. And if you choose to look at the source of those thoughts, that is the act of mindfulness. That's being the lion. That's looking at where that thought is coming from. The delusion of the dog is the reacting to the stick is how karma works. That's reacting to old karmically conditioned habits. running after those thoughts, running after yesterday, running after tomorrow, running after the worries, the fears, the greeds, the angers, and oh, what did old so-and-so think, and blah, 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 blah. Jabber, jabber, jabber is the way one monk put it. When our volitional actions are based on ignorance, the results we feel as suffering. The purpose of suffering is to help us learn. If something doesn't show us our ignorance, we're going to continue to do the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. So if we want different results, we have to be more like the lion instead of being the dog. And we have to start looking at what it is that the mind is actually doing. And that requires an act of will, choosing to look. Somebody was complaining recently about the fact that she's never meditated, and I was just pointing out that seeing all the places where you're not meditating is, in fact, when you're meditating. You have to notice that you're not meditating in order to do this. You have to see where the mind is wandering. You have to see where you're chasing the stick. You have to see where the mind is off in yesterday or tomorrow or wandering around in order to bring it back. Her Master Diyu said that birth was caused by what she called a critical mass of karma that needs a body. We're actually all little karmic cleansing washing machines here. And we can either do the job or we can pass it on to somebody else, another washing machine repair person. It's not helpful to think that this karma has all necessarily come from one source. It comes from all sorts of different sources, and she used to use the image of the compost pile. You just, big shovel gets stuck in, and that shovel of compost has all sorts of beings in it. It's got old apple cores and orange rinds and worms and leaves and rotted, all sorts of rotted eggshells and stuff in it. And that's what we come into this existence with, is a whole compost pile full of rotting stuff, and we need to turn this into good nourishment. All this compost is very nourishing stuff if we know how to use it properly. And somebody else has treated it as garbage, but the cosmic Buddha treats it as compost. Because he sees the good in it. And so the things that we experience as suffering has to be seen as compassion. Because it is the thing that points out our ignorance. And until we're aware of our ignorance, we're just not going to make any real effort to change. One monk would ask Reverend Master Jiyu once, he says, "Well, why am I so angry?" Being somewhat angry with herself at the time. And Reverend Master just said, "Well, it's because you're not fed up enough." And she said it with a big grin on her face. There is a use in desperation. Sometimes we've got to be desperate enough to really grasp our will and say, okay, I am going to do something about myself. I really am going to just sit here and find out what happens. You can't understand karma unless you can see that there's no self. Because we identify ourselves with our minds, we think that there's a me. And we identify ourselves with our bodies, our form, sensation, thought, activity, and consciousness are the five places that we identify a self with. And remember, Master Jiva has this really wonderfully clear explanation of what this is. What people usually think of as their self, soul, or spirit, those are all in quotes, is actually an impermanent combination of several components. Some components, such as the ego, the sense of self, the body image, and the like, are personal and individual, but they're continually changing and do not survive death. Another component, the Buddha nature, because it is one with the Buddha essence of the universe, is unchanging and eternal, and yet, for the very same reason, is neither personal nor individual. A third type of component is what is known as karma. This is the spiritual force set in motion by all volitional actions, whether good or ill. When we speak of a person's karma, we refer to the sum total of all such forces currently remaining effective, which he or she has produced in this lifetime or has acquired at the time of conception from other beings, which had left it unfulfilled at the times of their deaths. Positive volitional actions produce positive karma, sometimes called merit, which has positive effects on living beings. This positive karma, already being at peace by its very nature, is at one with the infinite sea of merit of the cosmic Buddha upon the death of the individual, and thus produces no basis for an immortal soul. So it's good to get rid of it as often as possible and keep offering it to people, because you can't take it with you. Negative karma, if not exhausted or purified in this lifetime, continues on after death and conditions the conception of a new being who will have an opportunity to allow it to run its course or to purify it, thus setting it to rest. Allowing it to run its course is a little ambiguous there. If in fact you allow old karmic reactions just to pass through, that's actually how you purify it. If you start reacting on those old karmic habits, you make more of the same thing that you just decided you didn't like. And it's very important to see the choices that we have when old karma arises, to see when those greeds and angers and fears present themselves. Once the force is spent, negative karma ceases to exist. In other words, if you let that thought come in your mind and let it go, it doesn't have any force of its own to continue on. It only has force if you identify that with yourself and act on it. If you let it just go through, a greedy, angry, fearful thought, a worry, impatience, if it just goes through, it doesn't have any force. It only has enough energy to arise. You're the one who has to choose to give it energy, to give it life, to buy into the delusion that it's selling. I'll go into that in a minute. Once its force is spent, negative karma ceases to exist. Hence, it too cannot produce an immortal or individual soul. The karma produced in this life and the karma inherited from other lives, from other beings, and they are indistinguishable. Thus, in Buddhism, there really is no such thing as an individual or immortal soul. We use the term spirit here to refer to the entire matter described in above, which I will read. But keep that in mind as I read what she's talking about in this paragraph. Where she refers to spirit, She's referring to this karmic energy that you identify with, or we identify with. The law of karma is inevitable and inexorable. The spiritual aspect of the so-called individual spirit, which a being, male or female, has thought of as himself or herself, returns to the source, called herein the Buddha nature, in its entirety, only if all past karma, both of this life existence just ended and those life existences prior to it, has been purified. For example, a person who has lived an exemplary life during this lifetime may still not become one with the Buddha nature if he has not looked deeply within himself and purified the karma he inherited from former lives. That part of the karma which is purified, however, returns to the Buddha nature, becomes one with it. So that which is being thought of as an individual spirit becomes divided up, like returning unto like. The purified part of the spirit returns to the Buddha nature, and the unpurified part is reborn in whatever is a suitable form for its presently unpurified state. It should be noted that spirit, however uncleansed, is still spirit, and herein lies its ability to bring life into existence, no matter how debased the form may seem. Thus, a person who kept all the precepts except the prohibition against carnal lust would find only the lustful nature of himself reborn as we know life, probably, but not necessarily, in an animal form, or as one who those unfortunate humans who are always in trouble for carnal acts which they have not committed. The purified karma of his former life returning to its rightful home in the Buddha nature. For centuries, the argument against rebirth has always been statistical, i.e., if a person dies, another must be reborn in his place. So why is the world's population always changing? Rebirth does not work this way. The physical body disintegrates and becomes recyclable material for use by the as yet unpurified karma-carrying sparks of spirit. These sparks become living organisms exactly in ratio to their own unpurified karma, and are thus again given a chance to transcend that karma by purification, thereafter returning directly to the Buddha mind, sometimes called the Buddha nature. You notice in the poster of the six worlds, which are all the places that you can get reborn into, or karma can get reborn, there is a picture of a Buddha or Bodhisattva. And it's like one of the teachings that the kindest Kanzian is found in hell. Because in the worst places of suffering, there's also the greatest kindness available to us. And it's because in heaven, for example, is considered the most dangerous of places because life is too easy and you get complacent and then you don't make the effort to change. So the human state is considered the best because not only can you experience suffering, but you can use it, make good use of it. And you have a full range of choices. And although animals don't seem to have as many choices as others. I was telling Rev Master Jihu a story once about this, the old cat of mine. I was giving him a bath because he was mostly a street cat, and he rarely showed up. But when he did, he always brought his friends with him. And he had an abundance of fleas. And my method usually of giving a cat a bath would just to get a big bucket of warm water and pick up the cat by front and back legs and dip him in the warm water and then soap him up and then rinse him off again. I had him by both front and back legs, and we were headed for the bucket of water, and he saw the bucket of water and he was going to take a big chomp out of my arm. And I paused for a minute and I thought, well, the next thing in my life is going to experience cat bite. And I went on to dump him in the water, and at that moment he turned away and decided not to bite me. And Master Jihu said, that's an example of a cat converting his karma. He was taking a volitional action to trust. And we could learn a lot from old Mr. Boo. Because it's precisely at that instant when we want to lash out at somebody or want to run away from something that's fearful. If we can trust in our meditation, if we can turn away from that karmic reaction to bite or to grumble or to snap at somebody or to lash out or run away, that's the moment at which the karma gets converted. Because you're taking a volitional action to not react. You're being aware of what the mind is doing, and you're choosing to turn in another direction. And a lot of karma gets converted right at that point, because that's a choice. And volitional actions, when we choose to act on greed, anger, and fear, we create more karma that encourages us that the greed, anger, and fear is really something that needs to be acted upon. And the more you can get to that point where you're feeling stressed out and you're feeling angry, and somebody comes up and says something to you and you snap at them, if you can just at that moment be aware, I'm stressed out, I want to snap at this person, don't do it. Just put a cork in it right there. And it's not a repression. It's a turning away from the old habit. It's allowing it to go. And it's very different from repressing it and just being resentful and hateful. It has to do with just relaxing into that tension. I just loaned my stretching book the other night to somebody, and I remember this really good teaching from the stretching book, which said, when you reach the place of tension, relax into it. And if you stretch too far, pull back a little. And that's really good instructions for learning how to meditate. Because when you really think you're stretched too far, that's when you're likely to get angry or fearful, or worries are going to arise, or you're going to find something to get upset about. And if you recognize what the body and mind are doing, you say, oh, I'm really stressed out here. This is the time. Yesterday, remember yesterday I snapped at so-and-so? I'm not going to do that today. Being aware of what our mind and body is doing is the real key to be able to change our behavior. Because when we get stressed out, is the perfect time to go running after that same old stick. Because that's the habit. When we're stressed, we feel we can't really do as much in the way of being mindful as when we're relaxed and alert and everything is fine and we've had our good meal and our cup of tea and our cup of coffee or whatever, and we're feeling good and it's nice and everybody's been nice to me for the last half an hour and I... That's not the time when karma arises. It's when we're expecting an opportunity. I remember I'm doing a memorial on the 5th. And when this man died 14 years ago, I just finished a weekend retreat for the 4th of July and the festival ceremony and everything. And it's Monday morning, and here I'm thinking, ah, oh, I just saw that somebody had just given me this picture of this big leopard that was hanging from a tree with his paw hanging down like this thing, totally relaxed. And I thought, oh, yes, today I'm going to relax. And of course, early in the morning, I get a phone call. Patrick is dying. You've got to come over right this minute. People don't die when you want them to die or when it's convenient. And it's just one of those things that you've got this reserve of energy when you really need it. And when somebody is dying or somebody's just had an accident or something happens that's unexpected, you actually, if you choose to sit still, you have this unlimited resource of compassion there to draw on. But you have to remember to do that. You have to remember that you can go there. Because the mind and body are saying, oh, I'm tired, oh, I don't want to do this, oh, I was expecting to rest, oh, I was, you know, have this, all this expectation. And you've got to be able to let that go. And it's a constant process of letting those things go. But if you can do that in meditation, where the thought of yesterday's lunch came up and you let that go, well, you can let the thought of, oh, I was going to have a nice, relaxed morning, instead of being with people who are dying or a family that's likely to be upset or whatever else is going on. And it's precisely being mindful of the choices that allows you then to make volitional actions, take choices that will in fact help. Because we've created the karma as a result of choice, and we can purify it by getting our choosing to get ourselves out of the way. It's a choosing to sit still. The eternal, the Buddha nature actually purifies the karma by allowing that thought to pass through. We don't actually have to purify it, or we just have to step out of the way. It's like somebody was questioning me about the freeway yesterday. This young doctor was here, and he said, oh, this is a very quiet place, but it's right next to the freeway. And I said, yeah, that's the really good analogy for meditation. Got all those cars going back and forth. And it's not your job to go out there and stop traffic. It's not your job to stand in that front of that truck and get run over. Just let it go back and forth. It's not your job. You know, the highway patrol takes care of that. Your job is to pay attention when you're on the freeway. Your job is just to be still. And if you can treat all the thoughts like the cars in meditation, they're not you. But if you can treat the emotions, the greeds, the angers, the fears, feeling stressed out, feeling frustrated, feeling worried, just like the cars on the freeway. It's because you don't identify with the cars on the freeway. Oh, I'm not a car. I'm not a Mack truck. No, I might be a Ferrari or a Maserati or something really nice, but not those cars. And seeing how that identity with the thought is a way of freezing it. Clutching. Here born we clutch at things and then compound illusion later on by following ideals. That clinging is what causes suffering. You can cling to the nicest thing in the world, and the fact of your clinging is going to turn it into suffering. Because the holding on is what turns anything into suffering. Letting go is what allows you to learn from all of that. Even your worst suffering is the thing that will help you the most if you let it go. Because you learn to let go, you learn that you have that choice to open your heart, step out of the way, just let that gold Mack truck of karma go on down the freeway. You don't have to make it into something you like. You just have to step back, step out of the way, shift your attention. What is the mind doing? The Buddha mind is always there. There's this underlying sea, infinite compassion. And you can put your attention on that underlying sea of compassion if you choose to. There was a Tibetan lady who said to Milarepa, she said, when I meditate in the great ocean, it's all very peaceful. When I meditate on the waves, my mind is in turmoil. She said, teach me to meditate on the waves. And he said, the waves are just the play of the ocean. Let them subside into its vastness. It's just that simple. We get caught into trying to hold on to those waves. There was a cartoon with one wave saying to another, look how big and important I am. Mm-hmm. Well, because of the above, she's referring to here the lack of self. Because of the above, it is impossible or even stupid to expect a human baby to be born every time another human dies. Anything can be born as a result of any death, whether human or animal, and because every being in the world has done totally different things from everybody else, there is no formula that can be laid down as to what will happen specifically to anyone. Only the individual can do something about that for himself or herself through meditation. All that can be truly said is that certain acts will have adverse effects on new life and other acts will have beneficial ones. The Buddha's precepts are the nearest a person can get to a working formula for this purpose. And it's really important to see the precepts not as rules of moral judgment, but as explanations on how to act like a Buddha. I was feeling really annoyed the other day, and I was sitting there thinking, well, I could do this, that, or the other thing. And then I thought, well, can I do any of those things without breaking the precepts? And no. No. I guess I'll have to just give up being annoyed. There's a part of me that didn't want to do that. It's fun to have a good gripe every once in a while. But when you look at what the mind throws up, you know, it's going to be mean and nasty to that person because you didn't like what they said, or it's going to do this, or it's, you know, you just watch the mind run through all sorts of little programs, thinking that somehow that's going to make it better. It's really more like a little comedy routine. And when you can start laughing at how silly it is, then its force is taken away. Nor is just one being likely to result from the death of a previous being. An unconverted carnal lust may be reborn in an animal form. An unresolved confusion at the time of death may be reborn as in a muddle-headed human. A secret and hidden evil act may cause the birth of a fixed or wandering ghost, just to give a few examples. Thus, the death of one human could result in the rebirth of an animal, a human, and a ghost, all out of the unpurified karma of that human's karmic stream, which will then become purified in its own way to become a beautiful part of the Buddha mind. Such unpurified karma becomes a karmic debt which the newborn creature inherits. Thus, Buddhism says with absolute truth that that which is reborn is not the same spirit as that which died, nor is it different from it. No being keeps his imagined spirit intact at death. In the case of one who has purified every karmic jangle within that spirit from the time it was part of the original Buddha nature before the universe began and to the present, that which was his or her spirit returns in its entirety to the Buddha mind at the time of death. For it is indeed the whole of that Buddha nature and loses its individual identity, leaving nothing whatsoever to be reborn. So that's what happened to the Buddha at his death. That's parinirvana, when there's no karma left to be cleansed. Just all goes back to the Buddha nature. Therefore, there is no individual soul, and thus the Zen master can say with truth that enlightened action leaves behind it no speck of dust, no wake, like the bird who flies through the sky. Very occasionally, a person may be the inheritor of a lot of the karma from one particular previous existence, and it may seem to him that he has inherited the equivalent of a whole previous personality. This is the main cause of the belief in reincarnation. However, one should know that however much karma a person may inherit from one place, he still will not inherit an individual soul, since that which was purified in the former being will have returned to the cosmic Buddha. Now, that doesn't exhaust all there is to know about karma. But the important thing in learning about karma is really learning about ourselves. Because the more we learn about ourselves, the more we see what it is that we do in terms of choosing to act. Because when we're aware of what the mind is doing, we're aware of where the mind is choosing to put its attention. That is looking back to the source of the thought. If we're like the dog chasing the stick, then we're just going with the reactions. We're not looking at what the mind is doing. We're looking at this tape that's being played. So we have to come back to the source there. What is the mind doing? Where is this great ocean here? We're splashing around in the waves. Sometimes we're surfing. Sometimes we're getting overwhelmed. Sometimes we're complaining that there's a storm. Sometimes we're complaining it's too calm and boring. But we have to look at what it is that we are complaining about. Because only when we can see that, oh, here we go, the mind is complaining again. What's beneath that complaint? Where does that come from? If we look deeply enough, we'll find that there is total emptiness there. There's total stillness beneath that complaint. It has no substance. It's always a bit humbling when we realize our deepest complaints and fears have no substance. It takes the wind out of our karmic sails. Realize that the ego is just a big balloon. Pure awareness is the looking at the source of the thoughts. It's not chasing after, it's just noticing. Reverend Master Jiyu loved to quote Ko Zenji, who said, "Under my robe this morning, a flea was walking. Just I noticed it had strong legs." Now, most of the time, when we have fleas walking, or ants crawling, or things itching, we don't just sit there noticing. We're going, or and the meditation is to notice what we're doing. And if we notice before we started to take the action, we have a much, much wider range of choices than after we've reacted. But once you have reacted, notice, okay? Oh, I just snapped at somebody. I'm sorry. Oh, I just grouched about something. Forget that. Just see what it is that you need to do right then and there to make the change. If you can catch it before it's actually gone to speech or to action, that's great. But look at the thought, too. You can't be in a room with an angry person without noticing. And people can't be in the same room with you if you're angry or fearful, because it just radiates. And karma is created by thought, by words, and by actions. And even though you may have not said anything or done anything, sitting there indulging that anger or putting energy into that fear is still radiating all that stuff. And you're choosing to do that, because you can also choose to let it go. To watch what the mind is doing is to see that this thought can come up and it can just be like the flea. You don't have to squish it. You don't have to kill it. You don't have to do anything with it. Let it go. If it stops and bites, it stops and bites. let it go. It's just like the cat. Well, he may bite, but he didn't this time. I've experienced cat bites since then. You can survive cat bite. It helps with antibiotics because they are kind of messy. But we can experience pain without turning it into suffering. And that's a little choice, again, you do with your mind. Pain itself is not suffering. Pain is experience. What got me meditating was a bad car accident where a driver had pulled in front of me right in the middle of the intersection, and I didn't have time to put on the brakes. And so, being a foolish young person, I had not put on my seatbelt, and I hit the windshield. While I was lying there for waiting them to take the glass out of my face, I was thinking, well, what's good to do here? Don't blink. Don't touch your face. Don't move. Just be still. Let the doctors take the glass out. They can see it. After a while, I just was telling myself, just be still. I fell into this place where I was there and the pain was there and it didn't hurt anymore. And I thought, ooh, this is interesting. It was just like sensation. It was just like, you know, the temperature of the room or, you know, just it exists and it's not a big deal. And it was after that that I decided, even though I'd read about Buddhism for 10 years, I hadn't actually done anything. So it was this impetus to get, I want to get in touch with that a little bit more. And so I started meditating. And that's actually what you're learning in meditation, is that you can choose to sit still, even though you may be in the midst of some very difficult or painful or unpleasant situation. You can put your mind into that place of stillness, and that changes your relationship with that the unpleasant event. It's just an event. You don't have to make it go away. You don't have to turn it into something nice. And you still have to recover from the injury, and you still have to go through the stitches and all of that stuff. But you can learn that there is a place of stillness that is this infinite resource of compassion that is within the mind at all times. And that's what taking refuge in the Buddha is about, is that you can go for refuge right in the midst of feeling threatened. And just because we have been chasing the stick for millions of lifetimes doesn't mean we have to do that. We might, the stick might just get caught by the lion. And we might have to stop and take a good look at who's holding the stick here. And when we start to do that, we change our relationship to those old habits. We see that we have choices that we don't always notice. And that range of choices becomes wider with the degree to which we are at peace or at ease, the degree to which we relax into that tension and open our hearts. Is the degree to which we have this range of choices that we otherwise didn't realize we had. And that, again, is a choice, but it's that choice to look differently, to look at the source of the mind, the source of the waves, to look at the Buddha nature, to look for a place of compassion. When you're feeling stressed out, when you're feeling angry, when you're feeling frustrated or impatient. Nobody can do that for you. All of our efforts, for example, to get other people to make our life pleasant by not giving us work when we don't want it, or not calling us when we don't want it, or by not giving us the food when we want it, or whatever. This is like the man who wanted to cover the entire world with leather so that he could have a soft place to walk. You know, just make your own shoes. Deal with your own mind. You know, just don't try to make the world do what you want it to do. See what it is that you can do about yourself. And in doing something about yourself, you in fact help all beings because you're taking the responsibility for cleaning that karma. And you're taking responsibility for seeing that there is a wide range of choices and that all I have to do is to be mindful of what it is that's going on. All I have to do is pay attention to the mind. And if you can do that, not just in meditation, but to do that throughout your day, and that means noticing all the places where you're not doing that. Notice when your mind is wandering. Notice when you're worried. Notice when you're grumpy. Notice when you're angry. Notice when you're afraid. And see, oh, I don't have to go there. It's just that simple. It's just like somebody's just throwing, small karma's throwing out these little angry sticks and fearful sticks, and you're running after it. You don't have to do that. You can teach an old dog new tricks. When I was moving to Santa Barbara, I had this dog named Shana, who was about 7, and I thought, oh, she's been in the country all this time, I got to tell her about streets. And so we practiced this for several weeks before we actually moved. And so I'd throw the ball and I'd tell her to stop. And the first time she just, forget it. So I had to hold her collar, throw the stick, stop. She got the idea, finally. So when the ball went into the street, when we were living in the city, I'd tell her to stop and she'd get to the curb and she'd wait and I'd go get it. She got a little bit older. She decided to use this for her own advantage. So after about 10 minutes of ball throwing, she decided, I'm too tired. I'll let it fall into the street and then he's got to go get it. She'd turn around and look. Actually, she was really quite streetwise as long as she wasn't with a person. I saw her one time when she gotten loose and she was coming back to the priory and she stopped at the street and she was watching the traffic and waited. And she was actually quite good, but not if you were throwing the ball. But not only can the old dog or the old person learn some new tricks, you can use them to your own advantage. And this is what it is to understand yourself, becoming your own best friend. This is what it is to have compassion for yourself. Because what we're doing by reacting to these old karmic habits is simply creating more of the same suffering, both for ourselves and others. And it just adds to the stuff that has to be dealt with. And somewhere along the line, somebody's going to be drawn to Buddha's practice and will actually want to do this. And this wanting to do this is the voice of the Buddha. If you really listen to the silence, you actually hear it. And if you've already heard it, or you wouldn't be here. Because whatever prompted us to come here is this little voice inside that says you can do something differently. You have choices. And it's the thing that gets our attention. You know, I'm like the donkey that our master used. Sometimes a donkey needs a 2x4. Between the eyebrows, and I still have a little scar of the 2x4 between the eyebrows from being the donkey. And we have to realize that the donkey is the stubborn part of us that simply doesn't want to change. But that's also the part of us that creates suffering. And we've got to become friends with this donkey and learn that the donkey is really a lot happier when it doesn't create the same habits, when it does actually listen. when it does choose to be still. Really important to notice how we identify ourselves with thoughts and feelings, especially greed and anger. Can you notice the feeling and let it go? Can you allow that feeling to come up? Be aware of what the mind is doing. Because being aware of what the mind is doing allows you then to see that that greed, anger, or fear is simply selling a delusion. The delusion of greed is that, yes, have to have something in order to be a whole being. The greed of anger is you have to get rid of something in order to be at peace. The delusion of the self is constantly selling these things, putting out, is that the external events there are the source of your suffering. And it's that turning the mind inward and realizing, oh, the problem isn't that thing out there. It's what I'm doing with it. And that doesn't mean you don't pay attention to what it is that's going out there. You don't stand in the middle of the freeway with your arms out in front of the truck. But we do that with our thoughts all the time. Told not to do that. And realizing that we are the ones who are buying into this delusion can be of real help in terms of seeing how to change that pattern. And this is what it is to becoming our own best friend here, is that we do not have to believe in the delusions. Our Master Ji said one of the hardest things was to realize that even though our parents and teachers might have sold us the delusions, we're the ones who are still buying them. And we have to forgive ourselves for having bought the delusions that others have sold to us. And our old karma is selling these delusions to us. And we have to realize that if I act on them, it's because I'm still buying them. It's this drug of self that says, oh, I'm fine. It's old so-and-so is the source of all my problems. I remember hearing the Dalai Lama talk about not seeing the Chinese as enemies. He was negotiating, this was 25 years ago or more. You see anybody as an enemy, he says, births and deaths are beginningless and endless, and you'll end up getting reborn in some relationship where you're going to learn to love that person. And in most of our relationship, there's a part of us that really sees that person as a somebody that causes all sorts of karma for us. And we have to realize that those relationships are there because we have to have that karmic button pushed and not by that delusion. Because that's the only place that it's going to get cleaned up. If we avoid all those difficult things, we're never going to actually confront those things that need to be confronted. Because we won't be fully aware of the range of choices that we have. And it's only when we're fully aware of the range of choices and choose to go to that place of stillness, to go to that place of refuge in the midst of suffering, we will not be able to clean up the karma. We have to see that that is a choice. That's why we come to meditation. We do the meditation in the quiet of our meditation hall, but if that's the only place you're doing it, then it's not going to do you any good. You have to do it when you're about to, hit somebody. When you're about to say to old so-and-so, or you're about to throw the cat across the room for it because he just bit you on the ankle, or whatever the thing is that you feel is the source of that suffering. Fear is selling the delusion. There is actually something to be afraid of. and that running away will actually solve the problem. Greed is the fear that we have are lacking in something, and we absolutely have to have something in order to be complete. Inadequacy is selling the illusion that we are really worthless and capable and fundamentally lacking. And you can buy into it if you want. It simply doesn't work. Going for refuge is choosing to find that place that is, in fact, adequate, that is whole, that is not disturbed. I have to read this because it's just so beautiful. Thoughts are the play of pure awareness. They arise within it and they dissolve back into it. To recognize pure awareness as to where your thoughts come from is to recognize that your thoughts have never come into existence, remained, or ceased. At that point, thoughts can no longer trouble your mind. When you run after your thoughts, you are like the dog chasing a stick. Every time the stick is thrown, you run after it. But if instead you look at where your thoughts are coming from, you will see that each thought arises and dissolves within the space of that awareness, without engendering other thoughts. Be like the lion, who rather than chasing after the stick, turns to face the thrower. You only throw a stick at a lion once. To recognize the nature of the mind is to recognize its emptiness. That is all. It is a realization that takes place in the realm of direct experience and cannot be expressed in words. To expect such a realization to be accompanied by clairvoyance, miraculous powers, and other extraordinary experiences would be to delude yourself. Just devote yourself to recognize the empty nature of the mind. Desire and hate appear like birds in flight, and they should leave no trace behind. In meditation, be free of clinging to experiences. Do your desire and anger have any form, color, substance, or location? If not, why is it that you fall so easily under their power? It's because you do not know how to set them free. You allow your thoughts and feelings to arise and dissolve by themselves. They will pass through your mind in the same way as a bird flies through the sky, without leaving any trace. This applies not only to attachment and anger, but also to the experiences of meditation, bliss, clarity, and the absence of thought. These experiences result from perseverance and practice and are the expression of the inherent creativity of the mind. They appear like a rainbow formed as the rays of sun strike a curtain of rain, and to become attached to them is as futile as it would be to run after a rainbow in hopes of wearing it as a coat. Simply allow your thoughts and experiences to come and go without ever grasping at them. I love the image of the rainbow is the image of where compassion and wisdom meet. The waters of compassion and the colors of wisdom. The colors of the light come together. And that's the place where karma is cleansed. And you cannot wear it as a coat. You cannot cling to it. You cannot actually define it in words. But you can do it. That's my wish for all of you.